Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have an interview with Stephen Houlihan, the Democratic-endorsed candidate running against Congressman Daryl Issa in the new 48th Congressional District, which now includes most of East County and more. He's a nurse, a former Santee councilman, and he has an MBA, or Master's in Business Administration degree. He'll be talking about health care, the Supreme Court's action to overturn women's reproductive rights, which Congressman Issa supports and Mr. Houlihan opposes, as well as other key issues including the economy, help for small businesses, climate change, and wildfire prevention for our region. Also on our show today, find out which hospital in East County got an A rating for patient safety and which one got a C. We'll also have a report on dueling proposals to address homelessness considered by the La Mesa City Council. Then on Crime Beat, hear the results of a sting operation in El Cajon at tobacco retail outlets and which ones have had their tobacco seller's licenses suspended due to selling to minors multiple times. Plus, from California News Service, we'll have a report on Mental Health Awareness Month in May and what mental health advocates are hoping to see in the new state budget. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in the heart of East County. Today, my very special guest is Stephen Houlihan. He is a former Santee City Councilman and a registered nurse, one of those frontline workers, healthcare heroes during the COVID-19 pandemic. And now he is running for Congress in the what's now the 48th Congressional District, used to be the 50th. So his opponent is Congressman Daryl Issa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. It's such a pleasure to be here. And I really appreciate you having me back.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. So can you start by telling people a little bit about the changes in the district now? Are there areas that maybe weren't in the district before? And what are the new areas that it's picked up? This is the big, you know, the bulk of East County, most of those rural areas out there.
Absolutely. Well, what's happened is due to the census, California lost a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. And so what had to happen was a reordering and a renumbering of all the districts. And so, and also with the census, every decade, each district is the borders are changed. Now, when we look at California's new 48th district, it really encompasses the vast majority of what was once California's 50th. It runs all the way to the border.
Right, Duncan Hunter.
All the way to Imperial Valley, but it also runs past Temecula all the way up to the city of Menifee.
Wow.
So the northern border has been expanded considerably. Also, it divides Escondido almost in a north and south manner, which is very interesting. So Escondido being split, it also splits the city of El Cajon in pretty much a east to west pattern. It encompasses all of Santee, all of Poway, which used to be in a completely different district. Now all of Temecula, Fallbrook, and then of course Ramona,
yeah,
and much of the East County, including Pine Valley.
Yeah, as far west as actually where I am right now, Mount Helix area, where my home office is the unincorporated portion of La Mesa on Mount Helix.
That's
is
correct.
Now in Daryl Issa's district, or your district, if you whoever wins the contest. So very
absolutely
interesting. So why don't you start, if you could, Stephen, by telling us a little bit about yourself and what qualifications or what about your background makes you believe that you would be a good congressman for this district?
The first thing is I'm a registered nurse. I've been a registered nurse for 25 years, and it just so happens this week is Nurses Week. And so, you know, nurses are the frontline workers in the fight against the COVID pandemic. Nurses are the, we're the ones that are there the day you're born, and we're the ones that are there the day you die. Not only have I been a nurse for 25 years, my background's in critical care. So that's where they, where you go when you have your open heart surgeries or when you're in a terrible trauma.
Yeah.
I've worked my way up into the administration of Sharp Healthcare, which is one of the largest providers in Southern California. And so I'm very, very fortunate to be very gainfully employed. I have a master's degree in nursing in healthcare systems administration, for which that's what I do. But I also have an MBA. So I have a master's in business administration. So I am an expert in Medicare. And if you know, Medicare takes up a large portion of our gross domestic product. So I'm very passionate about Medicare. And we'll touch on this when we talk about healthcare.
Well, why don't we start with that topic? What are your ideas on healthcare? What can be done to provide better access and more affordable healthcare for Americans?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing is we pay and spend more on healthcare per capita than any country in the world. And yet we don't get the return on that investment that we should. And so the first thing we need to do is we really need to shore up the Medicare program. So for instance, in Medicare, things like your glasses, they're not covered. Things like hearing aids. And, yeah. and you absolutely need glasses and hearing aids when you get a little older.
Yeah.
Your medications. We need to make sure that we can negotiate with the pharmaceutical corporations. So that way, you know, maybe they won't have quite so many commercials on TV for every show you watch, but yet maybe our medications would be at least at a market rate, like they are for the rest of the world. Now, the other thing is we need to expand Medicare. Now, many people would want a one-payer system immediately, and some don't want it at all. So I want to do what would be right in the middle. I want to expand Medicare immediately to those 55 and older.
Yeah, because, interesting idea. I just qualified for Medicare myself as of last month, but I know the last 10 years, our premiums went through the roof. I couldn't believe, you know, for my husband and I, we were paying more for our healthcare premiums than we were for a mortgage. So I think a lot of people would benefit from that particular idea.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing is the deferred care. So a lot of people, when they get up to 55 to 65, it costs so much for care, they defer the care.
That's true.
And then what happens is when you finally do hit 65 and you qualify for Medicare, you have to have that huge surgery. Then you have to have that bypass surgery. Then your diabetes is out of control. You know, all of the things that could have been dealt with through preventative medicine would have been much better dealt with between 55 and 65. So again, an immediate expansion to those. And again, it would be optional. You can qualify. And if you want into Medicare at 55, also when you retire, if you decide to retire before your 65th birthday, your COBRA costs, and again, COBRA would be the extension of your healthcare, will be astronomically high. So again, let people, if you're ready to retire, you shouldn't have to face massive debt in your healthcare coverage. Now, here's my other proposal. We need to bring forth what I call Medikid. Every child should be covered. And so it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that we have like St. Jude and Shriners always on TV begging for our money. It should be covered. When a child is dying of cancer, it's of no fault of their own.
Yeah.
You know, either they were unlucky or there was an environmental aspect. They should be covered and they should get the best possible treatment. Most dollars that go into healthcare are when the beginning of life, when you are born, and at the end of life, when you meet your maker. And so that's why I want to expand immediately Medikid, cover everyone up to the age of 18 and everyone 55 and up. And then those in the middle, if you can get coverage from your employer, that's great. But then we should still, you know, support things like Medi-Cal and make sure everyone has access to health care, not just health insurance, but to health care.
Okay. Let's ask a question from your MBA side there, Stephen. As the economy emerges from the COVID pandemic of the last 2 years and begins, you know, chugging back to life here, we're also seeing, you know, more people getting hired, job shortages, and we're seeing inflation, unfortunately. What would your take be on what steps should be taken to help the economy grow and keep the inflation under control or reduce it?
Another great question. And I think a lot of people don't really understand what's happening. And so we just understand that inflation is happening and inflation is bad. And everyone's lost for the root causes of such a thing. And so when one goes to business school and one understands business, you actually look into these causes. And so what we need to do to build our way out of this inflationary issue is we need to expand our gross domestic product. And so that means what we need to do is we need to have the supply of all of the things that we need so that the demand isn't so high on it that it costs more money. And so right now, everyone talks about fuel. And of course, you know, fuel is very, very expensive, understood. And so what we need to do is we need to create competition. Competition will drive down costs. And so what we need to do is we need to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, and we need to start subsidizing competition in the form of the electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging stations. And that way, everyone's not tied to need fossil fuels only. The other big thing we need is we need to make sure we have workers. Right now, we just passed a critical milestone, a deadly, terrible milestone of 1 million deaths directly attributable to COVID-19. But there are many, many more surplus deaths due to all sorts of other things, deferred care and of healthcare, people dying of all sorts of other causes. And so when you talk about gross domestic product, really the economy is people. It's not dollar bills. It's not green pieces of paper. It's not just zeros on a screen. It's about people, and we need workers. And so when you have the supply of labor that we need, which we're having a shortage of, it will drive costs down as well. For instance, the cost of food. Yeah. We need people who work as butchers. We need people that work and do these jobs. We need people that work in the fields. And those aren't necessarily the jobs that a lot of Americans want to do. Yeah. And so we need to do the right thing and be bringing in the workers we need. And so that's why I support the Modernization of Farm Workers Act. That makes perfect sense. There's people that want to do the work. We bring them in. The other thing is citizenship for critical workers. We have a critical shortage of nurses. I've spent my entire life working with nurses from places like the Philippines and India. And so they are critical, and they're the ones that care for you. And so, again, we need to provide them the pathway to come here. Also physicians. We have physicians from all over the world, you know, India, Persia, China.
On immigration, beyond the critical workers, small businesses have been so hard hit through the pandemic, and yet they are the backbone of the economy. Would you like to speak a little bit about your philosophy towards small businesses and how it might compare or contrast with your opponent, Congressman Issa?
Absolutely. Small businesses are the backbone of our economy. And small businesses are also one of the ways that individuals can change their station in society and you know, become more wealthy, because that's what entrepreneurism is about. And so what we need to do is we need to nurture small businesses. And one of the big things that happened with the first COVID relief bill, all the money that was meant for small businesses went to large businesses. And that was unforgivable. And people like Congressman Darrell Issa, they took huge sums of money when they're already billionaires.
For his business.
This is unacceptable. And so, first of all, what we need to do is make sure in the future, when we're providing financial help to small businesses, that it actually goes to small businesses, and that we're not just giving money to large businesses. So that was a huge mistake.
Yeah, and I believe he actually voted against COVID relief for the businesses.
He voted against it, but then he accepted the money.
Accepted money, yeah.
And that's terrible. You know how much I got? I got zero. I got zero. In fact, I pay my taxes. I pay a significant amount of taxes, and I don't have the choice whether to or not, because of I basically, you know, I pull the you know, my W-2, and I pay my taxes.
There you go.
And so, but getting back to small businesses, what we need to do is we need to make sure that we're promoting them. We need to make sure that we're supporting them, and we need to incentivize them. And so what we can do is, again, at the federal level, we need to look at their taxation. And when we raise taxes on whatever, whenever, you know, whether it's a corporate tax, whatever, we need to make sure that we exempt small businesses from these things, because it's unfair. It's unfair. So when you get these big fat cats like Amazon who are knocking everyone out of business, we need to make sure that when you finally try to correct that, because again, people like Bezos, Musk, they pay very little tax in comparison to what they earn. In fact, they've made more money during after coronavirus hit than they ever made. And we need to make sure that we exempt small businesses. And so one of the things I did recently was they tried to put an Amazon facility right next to Gillespie Field. We rose up and we stopped it. Now, there's lots of people that are claiming that they did this, they did that, but it was the grassroots effort. That's what stopped them. And that's what's going to get me into Congress. It's the grassroots effort. I support small businesses. I go and I always go to small businesses. That's where my dollars go. But at the federal level, we need to do is we need to create a fair tax system that doesn't put all the taxes on the small businesses while exempting the large businesses.
Yeah, give mom and pops a break out there.
Give the mom and pa businesses, give them a break. Give them a break. And don't just support the Walmarts of the world. You know, don't just support the Amazons of the world. You know, we need to do the right thing. Just because, you know, when they're blowing all their money on a space race while there's people under the bridge dying in heat right now. And it's a sad thing that it's misguided. So it reminds me of when I read the book, The Jungle.
Upton Sinclair's novel about the meatpacking plants.
We're back. We've almost gone full circle. And so it's time to know where our priorities are. And again, the mom and pop stores there, that's where we're going to be able to stop this inflationary issue too. Because when you create monopolies like Isa does, because that's what he's known for. He is the Viper monopoly guy. He knocks everyone out of business.
For his car alarm business.
For his car alarm business. So that's all he does. He is the monopoly maker. He doesn't support small businesses. He supports big businesses and the creation of monopolies. I support small businesses. I support mom and pop stores.
Okay, thank you. What are your views about, you know, how to protect border security and also how you would handle the many people trying to get here, either as immigrants or refugees from, say, Central America, Mexico, and most recently, Ukraine?
Another great question. It all works together. So when you bring in, well, first of all, I support bringing in at least 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. We want to help in this terrible, terrible crisis. And some of those people may choose to stay, and likely many of them are skilled workers. I support bringing those that supported us in Afghanistan, translators and people that risked their lives with our men and women in the military. We need to bring them here. And again, they will fill a massive void in worker shortage. Also, a lot of people ask about the border. I've lived in San Diego's 48th and what was once the 50th my entire life. The border isn't just in crisis now. It's always been a crisis. There was never a time when it wasn't. And so what we need to do is we need to secure our border. We have a fentanyl crisis, an opioid crisis. So we need to do the right thing. We don't want cartels bringing opioids, fentanyl, and these sorts of things.
How do we stop that? It's up something like, you know, I want to say 900% fentanyl overdose deaths in the last couple of years here. Just shocking. And it seems to be getting worse every time we report on this.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's a manpower issue. So I coached Little League Baseball, and one of the fathers is a Border Patrol agent. And I talk to him every couple days, and he works long hours, and he works nights, and he works weekends. We have a shortage of manpower. And so what we need to do is we need to, first of all, make sure that there are enough agents there and that they're adequately compensated. they are doing the job. And so we need to support them. We also need to bring in the technology. And I'm not talking about the technology of a wall, because that they go over it, they go under it, they go through it. And so what I'm talking about is modern technology. You know, we need to bring in the technology that's needed. When we talk about the economy, border waits can be up to 2 hours. I remember going down across the border and never having to wait so long. So we need to look at ways of automation, of pre-checking people, so that, you know, you can sequester some people into the line of 2 hours, but there's others who are already pre-authorized and pre-checked. We need to expand those programs. Also, we need to make sure goods and services can move across the border more rapidly, and it should all be pre-checked. And so we can't do like they did in Texas, where you just all of a sudden start pulling over every truck. That just destroys our economy, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so it's unacceptable. So we need automation at the border. We need to fund the Border Patrol, and we need to have real security, not a structure. It's in manpower. And the other thing is we need a comprehensive reform of the immigration system. When people are threatened and their lives and livelihoods are destroyed in their countries, whether it be Ukraine or whether it be Guatemala, we need to treat them the same. And we need to look at our system, and we need to expand immigration courts so that we can really look and give them a decent, you know, opportunity. Because when we send someone back to a bad situation, we may be sending them back to their deaths. And then the last thing I'll leave you with is dreamers. We have thousands and thousands of people who are here that could be very productive members of our society and the dreamers. And they're not young anymore. They're in their 30s, sometimes 40s now. And there needs to be a pathway to citizenship for them as well. So by no means am I saying open borders, let everyone come. But what I'm saying is do it the right way.
Thank you. You talked a little bit about people having their rights taken away overseas, and we're seeing that on the verge of happening right now across the United States. Once this Supreme Court ruling comes out that was leaked, unless it's changed, it would completely overturn Roe versus Wade and eliminate abortion rights, even when a woman's life is in danger, even when there's rape or incest, you know, many others, as well as every other circumstance. Your opponent, Congressman Issa, I don't know if you're aware of this, but he signed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court asking them to overturn Roe versus Wade. So I think probably every woman listening, and many of the men too, would like to know, what is your position on abortion and beyond that, protecting reproductive rights in general? Because by taking away the privacy right, it could also put access to contraceptives, you know, birth control at risk, as well as things like gay marriage. So what is your take on, do you believe steps need to be taken to protect women's rights? And can you compare or contrast your position with your opponents on this important issue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been a nurse for 25 years. I understand this is a question of healthcare. I stand by a woman's right to choose. A woman should be able to make the decision on how and when she wants to have a child, when it's the right time, especially whether it is the right time in her life financially, if she has the support persons. And I'll say here, I have this button. It says Ruth sent me. And so, you know what? From beyond the grave. And I absolutely am passionate about this. And again, we need to make sure that we fight back. And we can't allow a minority report by a minority elected group of judges or appointed to tell us all what we need to do. This is sad. This is sad. And we're going back 50 years of progress being rolled back.
Yeah, if we take away a right to privacy, does that mean that everyone loses rights to privacy? Does that mean when we check in at an airport or go across a border that if the agents want to read everything on your cell phone or your personal computer, they can just do that? What's to stop them? Isn't that a privacy issue?
Well, what people don't understand is that Roe v. Wade is one of the only court cases that sets a precedent for everyone's right to privacy. And so the way that case law works is that every case is built on another case. And so when it comes to the right to privacy, whether it be your whatever right you want, whether it's gay marriage, whether it's interracial marriage, you know, whether it's not to have someone, you know, search and seizure, every one of these rights, it's all foundational on Roe v. Wade, which isn't about necessarily as much about abortion, but it's about privacy. And so when they turn this back, and when I was reading the brief, they're going back to like 12th century England to make this case.
Oh, yes. Justice Alito actually cited as an expert some guy from, you know, hundreds of years ago who also believed in burning witches and, you know, that men should be able to rape their wives. So it's pretty
drastic. This is terrible. So the case law, like I said, everything's built on case law. He had to go back to the 12th century England to find the case. And again, like you said, in a time when things were backward, when they believed that, you know, that the sun revolved around the earth and the earth was flat, you know, just complete insanity. So it is so important. It needs to be enshrined into our Constitution. I would go one step further. We need the Equal Rights Amendment for women should not only be passed, and it should include their right to privacy in the way they decide to have, you know, whether it's to have a child, whether it's to make that, what to them is going to be a conflicted decision to have an abortion. This is tough. And as a nurse, I know sometimes the fetus may not be viable. And so, you know, a woman may pass, she may die, and she may have other children to raise.
So you mean, you're talking about when a miscarriage occurs, but it's incomplete, and the fetus isn't expelled, yeah, she can get sepsis and die if they don't do something to induce the labor.
Or an ectopic pregnancy. That there are, and it's, there's so much more. There's so much more to this issue. And so again, I am on the exact opposite side of my opponent, who obviously has no understanding about what it's about women or about healthcare.
Thank you, Stephen. You said you wanted to talk about homelessness. What role for the federal government do you see to play in this issue, which obviously is on the minds of everyone across San Diego County? It's often ranked as, you know, the number one issue that citizens are concerned about. What are your thoughts on that?
So this issue is really important. And as a registered nurse, I have taken care of so many people who were homeless or houseless. And they hit hard times, and they've frozen to death. They've had hypothermia. They've been assaulted. They've been beaten. They've had drug overdoses. They need services, and it shouldn't be. Why would we wait until they have to get the most expensive services possible in a hospital? Why would we wait? So we need to have forward thinking, and we need to start addressing the root causes of homelessness before it gets so critical. We need real solutions. And so just building million-dollar homes out into our wilderness isn't going to do it. We have to build the right infrastructure for them. And that means things like drug treatment. We need to be proactive and make this service. It should actually be available to all. And there's such a stigma. We need to overcome the stigma, because what happens is it's looked at as a moral shortcoming when it's really, it's a healthcare issue.
Yeah. Same with mental health care is another one that, you know, absolutely. Why is it so hard to get coverage or to get access to mental health care for so many people?
That's the second piece. So we need to make sure that we are covering mental health, you know, care for people with mental health, whether it's, you know, whether it's the medications they need, whether it's the counseling they need, and not wait till they become homeless. And so again, this is something that could happen at the federal level. But we also, what we need to do is we need to incentivize a level of affordable housing. And so most developers aren't going to want to build the affordable housing component in each of the general plans within all of our cities, which it exists, because it doesn't make money. It's not as profitable. What they want to do is they want to change the zoning to the most profitable for each piece of land. And so what we need to do is we need to subsidize it at the federal level, because it's not happening at the state level. It's not happening at the local level. It's very expensive. And so what we need to do is put in incentives, tax breaks, direct financial incentives for development of affordable housing.
And how do you define affordable too? Because it seems like I hear a lot of people say, you know, it seems like if you're very, very poor, there's subsidized housing for you. If you're wealthy, you can afford to buy something. It's the people that are in the middle that are getting squeezed, you know, the middle to lower half.
That's correct.
And maybe they don't just want an apartment. Maybe they've got, you know, kids and they'd love to actually buy a house, but it's just not practical here.
The median price for a house in San Diego hit $1 million yesterday.
Oh my God.
So that's just the average house.
Wow.
So, you know, what's happening is the people who have families are being squeezed out. It's a great investment to buy. If you have a lot of money, you don't want it in the bank. And the stock market right now is very volatile. So people are buying the properties. It's highly competitive. So what we need to do is we need to incentivize allowing families to buy the homes. Because what happens is a family doesn't get to buy the home. It becomes an investment, which I'm all for being able to create those investments as well. But if you are always out competing families, then what happens is that same family has to rent the home from you and they never get that equity. They never get the benefit of being a homeowner. And so what we need to do is we need to incentivize sellers to sell to families. And that way that family in that apartment, when they finally do get the opportunity, they're not having to pay $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 over listing price. And these are the sorts of things that are occurring. And so another way we can help is what's called inclusionary homes, inclusionary housing. Again, I try to do that on the city council, because going back to what you said in the beginning, I was on the Santee City Council for 4 years. I was the vice mayor of Santee in 2019, and I was a proponent of inclusionary housing. And what that means is that when you build, say, 10 units, that maybe you build two of them at or below market price. And so that way, people within the actual community for which you're building the homes might actually be able to afford buying a home. It was an uphill battle because the developers don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And so what we have to do is we have to incentivize it at the federal level, so then the developers will do it. And again, so this is the way we need to help people at the bottom. People are at the bottom, with helping with drugs, alcohol, mental illness. And we need to have transitional housing for them. People in the middle, inclusionary housing, and also incentives to sell to a family versus to another investor who's bought 50 homes already. Always at the top. It seems like they're the ones that are subsidized. That's unfair.
Very interesting ideas there, Stephen. I want to circle back to climate change for a moment. Something in your plan on your website caught my eye that it seems like would also help address the wildfire danger. So I was going to ask you about, you know, your plans for making us safer from fires, but tell us a little bit about, you know, whatever else you have in mind for that, but also your ideas for undergrounding power lines in East County.
You know, talk about a no-brainer. Now, for me, I am the president of Save Mission Trails. A decade ago, I led the battle to stop a power plant, the fossil fuel burning power plant from being built at Mission Trails, and everyone agreed. Democrats, Republicans, no party preference. We all knew we didn't want a power plant within our park. Fast forward about 6 years, and they wanted to put a gas pipeline down the 15 corridor, which would have gone right through what's now the 48th.
Yeah, you were out there leading the charge against those projects. I remember that.
Again. And so this is my thing, is making sure that the ratepayer isn't the one footing the bill. And what happens when there's a big fire and Sempra Energy, you know, even if they are fined, it's always passed on to the ratepayers.
Yeah.
It always is passed on the ratepayer. Our grid is antiquated and outdated. It's one of our greatest liabilities right now, especially the cyber attack. And so one of the things we need to do immediately is we need to upgrade our grid. And one of the things that we could do immediately is undergrounding our power lines, especially in the backcountry of the East County, especially in California's 48th. And it needs to come from the federal level. And we need to take money and get money from the infrastructure bill that was passed. And we need to start doing it now. We just had a fire up in Crest right now. They're fighting it now. Homes up in Laguna Niguel burned within minutes.
Mm.
And this is incredibly dangerous. These are million-dollar homes that were built fireproof. There is no fireproof. Fire resistant. As soon as one goes up, they all go up.
Yeah, no, I've interviewed the fire chiefs about that when we did a 10-year special on the Cedar Fire, and every one of them said it isn't a question of if we'll have another major wildfire, it's when. There's been a lot of improvements made, but, you know, it can't really prevent it from happening.
90%+ of all fires are started by man. And it may not be a kid out there playing with matches like, you know, we saw with, with Smokey the Bear. It's man-made from our power lines, which start to spark in the hottest times of the year as they're going over dry brush. And so they need to be undergrounded. That's the first thing. But what we also need to do is we need to incentivize using renewable energy so that we're not creating this terrible loop of climate crisis.
Side question on that is, I know a lot of my residents in the very rural areas in places like Boulevard and Campo, some of them have voiced concerns about the wind turbines. A lot of people don't know each one has about 1,000 gallons of flammable lubricating oil. But, you know, I keep asking the question of what happens if you have a monster wildfire fueled by 100-mile-an-hour winds like we had in 2007, and that hits those turbines. Aren't they all going to go boom and start falling over? And they never have an answer for it, really. But there's a portion of East County, a small portion of it, that's located in what's considered the very highest fire danger risk area of any place in the country, the last time I checked. Should there be some federal guidelines maybe on the siting of these things so that if you're in such a high fire risk area, maybe they should be able to consider some other source of energy for that area, whether it's solar or something else, and cite the wind in windy areas that aren't high fire dangers?
I think you were reading my mind, because that was exactly what I wanted to bring up, is we don't need to put all of the renewables out in the desert and up in the East County. What we need to do is it needs to be distributive. And so if what we've been doing here, we've been leading the charge here in Santee of putting solar on rooftops. And this isn't a partisan issue. All the schools have been transitioned to solar. Mission Trails Regional Park, when I was on the Mission Trails Task Force,
now they have the battery storage for night, absolutely, which is why you used to say you had to have wind, but now there is an alternative.
You use battery backup. And so we can do this, but the thing is, they want to go out to like Cucumba and surround a whole town with it.
Yeah.
But that's because the big industries, they can make money that way. That's not the way to do it. And the same thing with the turbines. They put them so far away that, if everything happens, they'll burn up. And so what we need to do is we need to actually have the renewables near the location for which they need the power.
Makes sense.
Way you don't have all these power lines that are burning up and lighting us on fire. Because all these fires, the vast majority are caused by the power lines.
Yeah,
like power line in the wind.
True. Some of the worst ones here, including the 2007 firestorm in San Diego, the Witch Creek fire was blamed by the state regulators on power lines.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely. So there's so much that can be done. And in the meantime, it's a safety issue. Right now, we have a war in Ukraine, and then Russia's not very happy with us. And what do? They do cyber attacks.
True.
They do cyber attacks, and they're aiming at our grid. And if they can knock down enough substations, they could cause a cascade to knock it all out. And so we need microgrids. We need to do the right thing. And so when there's areas where you can use geothermal, you need to create microgrids. Places where it's sunny.
Yeah, Borrego has a microgrid, I think. But you're right. Why don't we have that, you know, for every community or group of cluster of communities at least, so that you wouldn't be vulnerable to something like that tri-state blackout that we all remember from a couple of years.
Remember that? The tri-state blackout? And that was one guy flipping one switch.
Yeah, in Yuma by mistake.
And I was at the hospital working at the time. And luckily, we have generators at the hospital. Otherwise, it is catastrophic for the patients. So again, that's a microgrid.
Good point.
In the hospital.
Yeah, very good point. If hospitals can do it, so can everywhere else. Stephen, can you take a moment to let our audience know who your major endorsements are, what endorsement or endorsements you're most proud of, and also where can they find more information about your candidacy in the 48th Congressional District?
I am the California Democratic Party endorsed candidate. And so I'm very proud of that. It took a lot of hard work. And so I have that very, very important endorsement. I have been endorsed by the East County Democrat Club. And again, I've grown up in the East County. And so I'm very, very proud as well, because they know me I know them, and these are my roots. I have been endorsed by the Fallbrook Democrat Club. And again, you know, far-reaching, Fallbrook being kind of on the very, the northern portion of San Diego County, it shows that I've been, you know, I've been reaching out throughout the district. I have the endorsement of the Poway Democratic Club, which again is another really important endorsement. I have the endorsement of the Democrats for Equality. And again, that's important as well, because I believe that equality is very important, whether it's for the LGBTQ group of citizens within the 48th or anywhere, whether it's people like myself who are in a biracial marriage and who have a biracial child, which I have. We're all equal. We are all human. When you cut us, we all bleed red. It's the same. And so it's really important. So having those endorsements is, yeah, that's huge. I also have the endorsement of my lovely wife, who without her, I wouldn't be here doing all of this. But, you know, it's not about endorsements necessarily. I need to run in a very difficult race in a very skewed district. It's skewed kind of a little bit more red than it was before as California
50. It is. I think it's about 5% more Republican than say when Duncan Hunter represented it. And it's, and of course, it's always been a conservative bastion. So
and that's okay, because I've grown up here my whole life. And so it's not only about reaching out to and getting endorsements from the Democratic Party. It's about reaching out to the hundreds of thousands of no party preference voters.
I was just going to ask you, yeah, looking across the aisle, what would you say to those declined to state voters or voters who might be Republicans or some other party? Why do you believe they should support you? What common ground do you have?
I've spent my entire life here in this district. I love this district. I'm an avid mountain biker and hiker. I've traveled from one end of this area to the other. I spend a lot of time out in the backcountry. And I believe we have that as a unifying factor. We all love our open spaces, and I want to protect them. When there's a fire, the fire doesn't burn Democrat or Republican. The fire will hurt us all. And again, I have ideas to try to help us against that. When the COVID outbreak came, it doesn't kill Democrats or Republicans. I'm a nurse. I don't ask you what your political affiliation is before I care for you. I care for everyone. And so, again, it's not only about party affiliation. Now, talking about Roe v. Wade, the vast majority of us are reasonable. And I believe whether you're a Republican, no party, or Democrat, the vast majority would like to have the right to privacy and disagree with this. And that's a huge catalyst for my campaign. And also, when you do choose to have a child, we should be supporting you as well. So we should pull you out of poverty with things like the child tax break. Why would we allow 5 million children to go back into poverty after we were pulling them out?
Congressman Issa had voted against that, if I recall correctly.
He voted against everything. He voted against children. He voted against anybody here who's listening getting a COVID bailout when you got your $1,400.
That's right.
But he took $400,000 for his real estate business. What is that about? He voted against capping insulin at $25 a vial. He voted against coverage of veterans who get cancer from burn pits.
Oh my gosh.
Voted against everything. I mean, he does not represent us. I represent California 48. I love California 48. I probably cared for so many of your family members you wouldn't even know. You probably met me and you don't remember. And so, please give me the chance. Go to my website. It's electhoulihan.com. So easy. Elect Houlihan, H-O-U-L-A-H-A-N. Or if you prefer, follow me on Twitter at Elect Houlihan. Or find me on Facebook at Elect Houlihan. Or if you're one of those youngsters and you're about Instagram, you can find me at Elect Houlihan. And for the baby boomers out there that don't do electronics, just remember MASH, Nurse Houlihan, Vote Houlihan. Let's take back the 48th. We haven't had representation for like 20 years. It's been terrible for us. It's not about political ideologies. It's about doing the right thing. And that's what I'm going to do for you when I get in Congress.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for taking the time, Stephen Houlihan, to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Marie Johnson with a health report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. The Spring 2022 Hospital Safety Grades Report has been released by the LeapFrog Group, an independent nonprofit healthcare watchdog organization. It gave most local hospitals an A rating for patient safety during the pandemic, including Sharp Grossman Hospital in La Mesa, which serves East County. But East County's other hospital, Alvarado Hospital Medical Center, received a dismal C rating due largely to its below-average performance in preventing infections, including MRSA, a type of staph bacteria that is resistant to many antibiotics. Life-threatening MRSA infections can be spread when medical providers fail to wash their hands between patients. Alvarado received the worst rating of any hospital for both MRSA infections and Clostridium difficile infections. The hospital also ranked poorly on urinary tract infections and failed to provide information requested on surgical site infections after colon surgery. The report also cited communications issues in need of improvement. Alvarado had better ratings in other categories, including having enough doctors and nurses, as well as safety problems ranging from falls to bed sores and serious breathing problems. It also received the highest rating among all hospitals for its use of a computerized medication system to avoid medication errors that may occur with handwritten prescriptions. Alvarado had an A grade in 2019 and 2020, but fell to a B grade in fall 2021, and now to a C grade in spring 2022. Sharp Grossman Hospital ranked above average in nearly every category in the spring 2022 ratings, but did rank below average in some communications and certain post-surgical complications. Grossman also had an A grade in fall 2021, an improvement from B grades in 2020 and 2019. The LeapFrog Group also found that across the nation overall, the pandemic has had a negative effect on healthcare delivery at every level and setting, from staffing shortages to increased infections to the care that patients receive.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
This is John Tidwell with a local government report. The La Mesa City Council's May 10th meeting was a study in contrasts as elected leaders tackled a discussion over what to do about the homeless problem. One option was a proposal to join forces with San Diego County and the cities of El Cajon, Lemon Grove, and Santee, an entirely different approach offered up by Councilwoman Lori Lothian was to move the homeless to a 16-acre site up for sale in Campo, over an hour east of La Mesa, on land that was formerly part of the Camp Lockett military base. According to Lothian, it would be a place where the homeless could live, quote, kinda in the middle of nowhere, where perhaps the land could be farmed. The council opted to join forces with other cities and the county. The council voted unanimously to approve a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, proposed by Supervisor Joel Anderson. His plan amounts to a handshake among all involved to collaborate on work towards a regional solution. This includes cooperation in identifying potential locations to site low-barrier emergency housing and on-site services, as well as permanent supportive housing in each city to house unsheltered people. The City of El Cajon approved the MOU in April. The cities of Santee and Lemon Grove are anticipated to consider the MOU at upcoming meetings in May or June. Should La Mesa find the MOU is not working, it can just walk away from the deal. It is not legally binding. Assistant City Manager Carlo Fermino explained that in 2009, the city of Boise lost a ruling in the 9th District Court of Appeals, which found the city's ordinance targeting the homeless violated the 8th Amendment of the Constitution. The court held that issuing citations or arresting the homeless when no shelter beds were available amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. For La Mesa and other cities without shelters, it means jailing or citing the homeless is not an option. The La Mesa Citizens Task Force on Homelessness, created in 2019 by the council, has been striving to find programs to prevent homelessness and housing insecurity. The task force supported the city joining the collaborative effort with the county and neighboring cities. But council member Lothian noted that no one has been looking for a solution outside the community. She described how her job in real estate sales. She travels the city daily and sees problems such as vandalism and human feces in or near homeless camps. While she supports finding a solution, she questions the lack of input from the business community or neighborhoods in helping address the issue. As an agent, she knows how costly the land is in La Mesa, and instead suggested exploring the possibility of moving the homeless population to Campo at a cost of just under $5.5 million, adding, "There is nowhere else you can get a deal like this." The property also houses a Border Patrol station, post office, gas station, Baptist Church, VFW Hall, and 28 residential buildings, including former Army barracks. Lothian made clear that she has no personal interest in the property that she proposed the city consider purchasing. But when the council was asked for a second to her motion, the room grew silent. While no one spoke up to support her suggestion, when it came time for public responses, residents of Campo called in. Julie Valsco said she lives in a 200-home housing development near the site. She told the council, "There is a small sheriff's station that closes at 5 p.m. We don't have resources to do this." She also pointed out the danger of wildfire and asked how homeless residents would be evacuated. Judy Herbert, also of Campbell, wondered where the homeless might find work and how they would get there, since there is no mass transit in Campo. She said the late Father Joe Carroll tried to do a similar project in the backcountry, and it failed. Another resident of the area, Tina Reyes, said she is a healthcare worker and pointed out there is only one medical facility in the area and no hospital. She concluded, "Relocating is not solving the problem. You are just moving it from one area to another."
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A sting operation involving underage decoys found that 24 retailers in El Cajon sold tobacco to minors without asking for ID, in violation of the city's tobacco retail license inspection program. That's 23%, or nearly a quarter, of all outlets inspected. 9 of those were second-time violators in the last 3 years, and one retailer was a third-time violator. All violators, including first-time and repeat offenders, must pay a $2,500 fine. After a second violation, the retailer also faces a mandatory 60-day suspension. Third-time violators face a 120-day suspension, and if a retailer violates the ordinance a fourth time, their tobacco retail license must be permanently revoked. The violators include smoke shops, food markets, liquor stores, gas stations, and convenience stores, including 7-Eleven. USA Gas on Cuyamaca Street, the only third-time violator, will be suspended from selling tobacco for 120 days. Those facing 60-day suspensions as second-time violators include 3 7-Eleven outlets, Ash Smoke Shop, Kayleen's Market, San Diego Food Mart, Shell Gas Hamashaw Oil, and United Oil 76 Gas. The city modified its ordinance in 2019 to make second and third violations have more severe penalties, but also allows part of the penalty fine to be reimbursed if the retailer has staff get additional training. City Manager Graham Mitchell, in a memo to the mayor and city council, says it appears the amended 2019 code has had little to no impact on selling tobacco products to minors. But Councilman Gary Kendrick, author of the city's stringent tobacco retail ordinance, disagrees. He told East County Magazine, when we first passed the ordinance, 43% of the stores were selling to kids. That's substantially more than the 23% in the latest sting operation. Stings are held annually for most retailers selling tobacco and alcohol, but twice a year after the retailer has been caught selling to minors. Kendrick concludes, what it just shows is we just have to keep on them, otherwise they'll just go back to their bad behavior. At some point, the ones that don't behave and sell these poisons to kids will find themselves out of business, he concludes.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and advocates are hoping Governor Gavin Newsom will prioritize the issue in his revised budget due out by Sunday. The governor's January budget proposed $4.7 million to fund the California Parent Youth Helpline annually for 3 years, where people can connect with a trained counselor for free from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. Dr. Lisa Payan-Berlin is president of Parents Anonymous, which runs the helpline.
With greater resources, we could have more trained clinicians to answer the phone. The demand outstrips our capacity right now. We have people on waiting lists to get into our free online weekly support groups.
The service has helped more than 40,000 people in California since it started 2 years ago, but they'd like to help more of the Golden State's 9.3 million children. People can call the helpline number 855-427-2736 or go to the website caparentyouthhelpline.org. Last week was Children's Mental Health Acceptance Week, when people are encouraged to take action and reach out to another person who might be struggling. Payan-Berlin says no one should be blamed or shamed when they ask for help.
Parents need support in identifying and accepting that change in behavior, mood swings, sleeping patterns, change in friends that their children looks at, that they may need to seek help.
A 2021 study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that child suicide rates have been rising in recent years and that suicide is the eighth largest cause of death amongst children aged 5 to 11. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.